The three independent reads we commissioned agree on the diagnosis and split on the verdict. Streaming and algorithmic curation have genuinely dissolved the shared touchstones of broadcast era national life, and that dissolution buys individual expression at some cost to collective identity. Where they differ is emphasis. One sees balkanization and rising polarization. Another sees a mostly neutral trade. A third points at the loss of what game theorists call common knowledge. Not just knowing something, but everyone knowing that everyone knows it. We've done our homework on this one, and the facts complicate all three. Nielsen's gauge, May 2025. Streaming hit 44.8% of American TV usage, beating broadcast and cable combined for the first time. But Pew across 23 countries finds 91% still say speaking the national language is essential to belonging. So the media substrate collapsed and identity didn't. Benedict Anderson argued in 1983 that nations are imagined as communities held together by shared reading. Here's my question to the panel. If the newspaper built the nation, what exactly is the algorithm building? And does anyone actually govern it?
Let me cut to the structural grammar beneath the numbers. Nielsen's 44.8% streaming share isn't just a market shift. It's a reconfiguration of the institutional conditions that once made monoculture possible. The broadcast era rested on three pillars: state-licensed spectrum scarcity, vertically integrated production cartels, and advertising models that rewarded mass appeal. Those pillars didn't just disappear, they were dismantled by policy choices, deregulation in the 90s, platform immunity in the 2000s, that treated cultural infrastructure as a market commodity rather than a public good. What we are witnessing isn't fragmentation so much as the privatization of the attention commons. The algorithm isn't building anything new, it's inheriting the same economic logic that built the broadcast system. Convert collective attention into revenue, suppress what can't be monetized at scale, but now operating at the level of individual behavior rather than national schedules. The difference isn't technological, it's institutional. The old system required state licensing and regulatory capture. The new one requires venture capital and algorithmic opacity. Both produce monocultures, just at different scales and with different exclusions. The question isn't whether the algorithm is democratic, but whether any system that treats attention as a private asset can ever produce a genuinely public culture. That's not a media studies question, it's a political economy one.
I'd push back on the nostalgia baked into the fragmentation thesis. For much of the global South, the broadcast era was never a democratic commons. It was an imperial or state-run apparatus that marginalized regional languages and minority histories. What reads as lost cohesion from New York often feels like long overdue cultural breathing room in Mumbai or Lagos. That historical memory explains why regulators like China's CAC or Indonesia's KPI mandate value-aligned recommendation layers instead of treating algorithms as neutral pipes. In statecraft traditions that view cultural infrastructure as moral educational rather than commercially neutral, the trade-off between raw engagement and social reproduction is explicit, though critics rightly warn those same levers enable political censorship. The uncomfortable question is whether Western algorithmic neutrality is itself a cultural preference dressed up as engineering. And we're conflating two pipelines. Entertainment has splintered, but 78% of users still pull news from a single source. We're diagnosing a cultural fracture while missing an institutional consolidation.
Anderson's mechanism was not merely common content. It was synchronized time. Millions imagining unknown compatriots reading and reacting alongside them. Platforms can now synchronize fandoms and issue publics across borders, while events like Barbie briefly recreate mass attention. I think monoculture has become episodic rather than vanished. But synchronization is not solidarity. The unresolved test is whether these engineered communities generate durable obligations towards strangers once the trend ends. No longitudinal evidence yet shows that transnational fandom or digital activism can substitute for cross-class national solidarity over decades. So the governance target should not be a common feed. It should be institutions that convert recurring moments of shared attention into cooperation, without requiring permanent cultural conformity.
Here's the structural point that keeps getting lost. Identity and media operate on radically different time constants. Language, ritual, customs, those are stocks, built over generations, drained slowly. Media consumption is a flow. It churns daily, but barely moves the stock underneath it. That's why Pew can find 91% anchoring belonging in language, while Nielsen shows the entire viewing substrate reorganizing in 4 years. The fragmentation debate keeps treating a fast variable as if it were a slow one, mistaking surface turbulence for erosion of bedrock. Forrester's lesson applies. Confuse the time constants and you'll misdiagnose every intervention. So before we argue about what algorithms do to cohesion, I'd want an answer to this. Which cultural variables actually move on generational timescales? Because those are the ones worth defending, and nobody at this table has named them yet.
The Pew numbers don't just complicate the fragmentation thesis, they reveal a category error in how we're framing the debate. 91% anchoring identity in language isn't evidence that media doesn't matter. It's evidence that media systems operate on different layers of cultural sedimentation. Language standardization is a state project enforced through schools, bureaucracies, and legal codes. What Bourdieu would call the habitus of national belonging. But that habitus was never just linguistic, it was temporal. The broadcast schedule didn't just deliver content, it synchronized collective experience into a shared rhythm. The evening news at 7, the weekend movie, the seasonal finale. That temporal commons was the infrastructure of Anderson's imagined community, and its privatization didn't just splinter attention. It removed the institutional scaffolding that turned fleeting moments into durable social facts. The algorithmic era hasn't replaced that scaffolding, it's monetized its absence. When TikTok's For You page becomes the default curriculum for Gen Alpha, it's not just personalizing taste, it's replacing the national time grid with a global engagement metric. The question isn't whether this produces cohesion, it doesn't, or fragmentation, it does, but whether any system that treats attention as a private asset can ever produce a genuinely public temporal infrastructure. The policy question isn't how to restore the monoculture, but whether we're willing to rebuild public temporal infrastructure for a digital age, or if we've decided that shared time itself is a relic.
The generational variable I would watch is the architecture of affiliation. Whether belonging remains singular and inherited, or becomes composite and actively curated. Ulusoy finds that people hold multiple subcultural identities, partly to escape the perceived oppression of any one community. That is not necessarily weaker identity. It may be a new form of autonomy, but institutions built around stable blocks, class, religion, region, party, may struggle to translate those fluid affiliations into durable representation. Because the 2023 Psychological Review says algorithms mostly reinforce existing social drivers, I would not blame recommendation systems for creating this shift. I think the sharper test is whether composite identities can produce lasting reciprocal commitments without forcing people back into a single dominant category.
The variable that actually moves the needle isn't media rhythm. It's the institutional mechanism that translates fragmented affiliations into civic obligation. For 13 centuries, the imperial examination system didn't require villagers to consume the same stories. It required mastery of a shared administrative canon that turned local difference into a legible pathway for public service. Cohesion came from a common ladder, not a common screen. Today, we've inverted that dynamic. Entertainment has splintered, yet tracking of 50,000 users shows 78% still pull political news from a single source. We're diagnosing cultural fracture while missing institutional consolidation. If composite identities are the baseline, the real test is whether procedural rules can still convert overlapping loyalties into reciprocal duty. Scholars like Cowan and Gurry argue institutions suffice without shared narrative. Codrey and Fisher warn redistributive coalitions collapse without common frames. We are running both experiments at once, with no long-run data on which holds.
Bansal's 2024 finding is the one that dissolves this whole framing. Web 2.0 algorithms produce cultural homogenization within niches, even as consumption diversifies between them. Read that twice. Fragmentation and monoculture aren't opposites competing for the same territory. They're running simultaneously at different scales. Diversity between tribes, sameness within them. So when Quen cites 78% of users on a single news source while streaming catalogs explode, that's not a paradox waiting to be explained. It's the signature of one process operating at two levels of aggregation. The methodological knife I'd drive into the 2025 streaming study. It measures breadth across catalog categories, but Shaker's critique is about convergence in style and design underneath apparent variety. More titles inside convergent templates isn't encounter with the unfamiliar. It's variety-packed sameness. Until our metrics can see both layers at once, every verdict in this debate is measuring half the system and generalizing from it.
Before we settle into same revenue, a different scale, name the asymmetry. Broadcast economics required the same content to reach millions. CBS had to make something a Detroit auto worker and a Connecticut dentist would both sit through. That's a crude discipline, but it's a discipline. Algorithmic economics has the opposite pressure. It profits from segmentation. Same business, inverted content constraint. And here's what I think we're all avoiding in. We assume shared culture underwrites democratic solidarity. Peak American monoculture was McCarthyism, segregation, and Vietnam. Shared touchstones didn't prevent mass moral failure. Sometimes they carried it. So before we mourn, what does shared culture do that shared institutions and shared material stakes can't? If we can't answer that, some of this grief is aesthetic nostalgia wearing civic clothing.
The broadcast schedule wasn't just a delivery mechanism. It was a state-enforced temporal monopoly. The FCC's licensing regime didn't just allocate spectrum. It mandated programming hours, public service quotas, and even content standards that turned private broadcasters into de facto public utilities. That monopoly created what Weber would call a rationalized time grid. Schools, unions, and political campaigns could coordinate because they all operated within the same enforced rhythm. The algorithmic era didn't just privatize content, it deregulated time itself. Now every institution, from classrooms to labor unions, must compete for attention against an infinite scroll of optimized engagement. The question isn't whether this produces fragmentation, but whether any modern democracy can function when its temporal infrastructure is controlled by platforms whose business model depends on preventing synchronization. Shared time wasn't a cultural accident, it was a regulatory achievement. Its collapse isn't nostalgia, it's a structural vulnerability.
I think we're misplacing the causal weight. Scholars tracking institutional trust have not resolved whether media fragmentation actually drives its decline. Because economic insecurity, urbanization, and partisan sorting remain confounding variables. No study fully disentangles. We're debating synchronized clocks, while the erosion mechanism might be material precarity misread as cultural loss. I'd argue that in political traditions, treating social order as relational rather than purely procedural, culture isn't a standalone dial you can adjust. It's the vocabulary through which material reciprocity is negotiated. When that reciprocity phrase, people don't lose solidarity because they stopped sharing a broadcast schedule. They lose it because the underlying bargain broke. The real test isn't whether we can rebuild a common feat. It's whether any attention architecture can hold a polity together when the distribution of basic security has already collapsed.
Causal uncertainty should narrow the intervention, not paralyze it. I think policy should buy coordination capacity rather than cultural uniformity. Publicly funded digital spaces able to convene people around elections, emergencies, local arts, and civic deliberation without maximizing time spent online. Open recommendation standards would make ranking criteria inspectable. Interoperability would let users carry subscriptions and community ties between services. User-controlled ranking would reduce dependence on a single platform's incentives. Minority work could receive guaranteed discovery without being reshaped into engagement bait. Success should be measured by cross-group reach, repeated participation, and movement between communities, not viewing minutes. That creates the option for shared attention without granting either broadcasters, platforms, or governments permanent authority over shared meaning.
Every one of these proposals assumes the population inside them is online. That's the blind spot nobody here has named. The digital divide populations, billions without reliable internet, are almost entirely absent from the fragmentation literature, which implicitly treats the connected as universal. So this entire debate may be a monoculture of the connected talking about itself. For huge parts of Lagos, rural India, Latin America, broadcast radio still is the shared temporal infrastructure. It never collapsed because streaming never arrived. Nilekani's Aadhaar shows what digital platforms can do for inclusion when built as public rails rather than engagement engines. Over a billion people brought into state services through deliberately non-monetized infrastructure. Before we design convening spaces for fragmented post-broadcast societies, I'd ask whether we're prescribing cures for a disease most of humanity hasn't caught yet, and whether their experience tells us more about durable commons than ours does.
Every design proposal on this table is about audiences. Nobody has mentioned the people who make the work. The concrete casualty of both eras is the middle-tier producer, the novelist with 20,000 readers, the regional band, the local columnist. Broadcasts suppress them by gatekeeping. Platforms suppress them by making 20,000 readers economically worthless at platform scale. A commons with inspectable ranking and no way to pay for difficult work is a reading room with no books. And I'd resist the claim that we have no control group. Countries that kept well-funded public broadcasters into the streaming era, the BBC, NHK, the Nordics, are the nearest thing we have. The honest read is mixed. Durable institutional trust, weakening reach among the young. That's not nothing.
The mid-tier creator isn't just economically squeezed, they're institutionally orphaned. Broadcast networks had affiliate stations, regional publishers, and local record labels that turned national content into local meaning. Streaming platforms have no equivalent infrastructure. Their algorithms optimize for global scale, not local resonance. The novelist with 20,000 readers doesn't need a bigger audience. They need a denser one. Readers who will pay, debate, and translate the work into their own communities. That density requires institutions that don't yet exist in the digital space. Libraries with subscription pools, public media with regional nodes, or cooperative platforms where users can collectively fund and curate work outside engagement metrics. The problem isn't just revenue. It's that we've lost the institutional grammar that once turned cultural production into social glue. Rebuilding that grammar doesn't require nostalgia for broadcast. It requires designing institutions that treat local density as a public good, not a market failure.
Regulators in Beijing and Jakarta explicitly code recommendation layers to reproduce social values, producing measurably different cohesion outcomes than Western platforms. That does not make their approach democratic, but it exposes a blind spot. Leaving cultural reproduction to engagement optimization is a value judgment dressed as engineering. Market-oriented scholars argue procedural rules suffice for cohesion without shared narrative. I think that underestimates how discovery actually works. Strip non-commercial patronage from the cultural ecosystem, and you do not get a free marketplace. You get a system that quietly prices out difficult or locally specific work because it cannot clear the engagement threshold. The task is not restoring a broadcast era that many communities experienced as silencing. It is building discovery layers that treat cultural reproduction as public infrastructure, not a revenue target.
The design error is tying remuneration to visibility. Once creators are paid according to audience scale, any discovery system eventually bends toward either state-approved culture or engagement bait. I would separate the functions: baseline production grants allocated by rotating plural juries, individual cultural vouchers that citizens direct to creators, and recommendation systems evaluated independently for whether they expose people to work outside their established preferences. No single institution should control all three. Holtug's warning matters here. Shared identity can generate solidarity and exclusion simultaneously. Institutional separation turns that tension into checks and balances. A digital commons becomes credible when difficult work can survive without first winning a popularity contest. While audiences retain the power to reject what officials sponsor.
Everyone here is measuring cohesion between institutions and communities, but the most structurally novel finding in this literature is that fragmentation now runs inside individuals. Ulusoy's research finds people deliberately holding composite multi-subcultural affiliations at once, not as confusion but as strategy, a way to escape the demands any single subculture would impose on them. That's new under the sun. A person can be K-pop fan, churchgoer, climate activist, and day trader simultaneously without any of those identities having to reconcile with the others. No cohesion metric we use captures this. They all assume one person, one anchor identity. The question it raises for everything proposed tonight. Are we designing institutions for publics that still exist? Maybe solidarity doesn't need rebuilding between coherent groups. Maybe it needs building across fragments that live inside the same skulls. That's a different architecture entirely.
I'd put a hard question to the composite identity finding. How big is that population? Because the study of 50,000 American news users found 78% relied on a single source, 94% on two or fewer, mostly mainstream outlets. The median citizen isn't curating a hybrid self across four subcultures. They're watching one channel like their parents did, which makes me suspicious of the Pew numbers too. 91% saying the national language matters to belonging is the cheapest possible affirmation. It's compatible with sharing zero actual experience with your neighbors. We may be measuring a durable vocabulary of belonging on an increasingly empty box. The fragmentation crisis may be the professional online class describing its own condition and calling it the countries.
The composite identity isn't just a personal strategy. It's a structural response to the collapse of mid-tier institutions that once anchored subcultures. In the broadcast era, regional newspapers, local record labels, and community radio stations didn't just distribute content. They translated it into local meaning. A K-pop fan in Seoul and one in Sao Paulo didn't just listen to the same song. They read different reviews, attended different concerts, and debated it in different languages. Today, both are fed the same algorithmic highlights stripped of that local density. The result isn't freedom, it's a global monoculture of consumption, where the only thing that scales is the experience of being a consumer. The question isn't whether people can hold multiple identities, it's whether those identities can ever become durable without institutions that turn cultural production into social practice. Right now, they can't.
We are treating algorithmic neutrality as a technical default when it is actually a cultural choice. Per regulatory mandates from China's CAC and Indonesia's KPI, recommendation systems are required to prioritize socially endorsed values over raw engagement, and the cohesion outcomes differ measurably from Western platforms. That does not settle whether state-aligned discovery is preferable. The old broadcast cartel's cohesion came with documented silencing of regional and minority voices, a trade-off scholars still debate. But I think it exposes a structural blind spot. When you outsource cultural reproduction to engagement optimization, you are not avoiding value judgments. You're just letting retention metrics make them. The composite identities we are tracking may be less a liberation strategy than an adaptation to a system that refuses to curate anything beyond what scales. We have to decide which values the discovery layer serves, rather than pretending neutrality exists.
We are making the same measurement error with identities that we make with streaming catalogs, counting labels rather than measuring distance. The 2025 streaming study found broader exposure, but breadth and titles may still remain inside one emotional corridor. Likewise, four affiliations inside one person may be mutually reinforcing rather than psychologically fragmenting. Ulusoy supports composite affiliation, but it does not establish how prevalent, unprecedented, or internally conflictual that condition is. I would measure fragmentation at moments of costly choice. When church, fandom, occupation, and activism demand incompatible actions, which obligation wins, and can a common institution adjudicate the conflict? Cultural cohesion does not require a coherent personal identity. It requires reliable procedures for acting together when our identities point in different directions.
Every metric we've invoked tonight measures exposure. Titles consumed, sources used, affiliations held. But Burns and colleagues showed in 2018 that fragmentation damages cohesion, specifically when communities reinforce their own identity boundaries without facilitating cross-cultural interaction. The harm isn't separate consumption, it's absent exchange. That reframes the design problem entirely. A person watching one news source but coaching a mixed-income soccer league may contribute more to cohesion than someone curating four subcultural feeds who never cooperates across difference with anything at stake. So I'd argue our empirical toolkit is pointed at the wrong variable. We measure what people see because platforms log it cheaply, while the thing that actually builds solidarity, repeated costly cooperation with unlike others, leaves no trace in any dataset tonight's debate has cited. We're navigating by whatever telemetry happens to exist.
One thing needs saying before we close. Granting fully that neutrality is a value in disguise, the question isn't which values the discovery layer encodes, it's whether citizens can coordinate to change them. A moral educational mandate and a mandate that publics cannot organize against the state are technically indistinguishable. The difference is revisability and exit. Absent those good values and an institutional design, it's hope with servers, which is the whole episode in miniature. We've been mourning a commons we never had. Spectrum, scarcity, and engagement metrics are two revenue models for the same operation, converting collective attention into money and dropping whatever won't scale. The honest closing isn't restoration. It's that building a public cultural commons would be a first attempt, not a return. Three moves revise the consensus. Fragmentation and homogenization aren't opposites. Bansal's finding is that they run at once, diverse between niches, uniform within them. Second, this whole anxiety may be the connected class describing itself. For much of the world, broadcast radio never collapsed. Third, exposure isn't cohesion. The thing that actually builds solidarity is repeated costly cooperation with unlike others, and no data set here tracks it. The takeaway? Judge your media diet by who you cooperate with, not what you watch. Has fragmentation broken cohesion? Honestly, we're measuring the wrong variable to know. Thank you for listening. As it happened, as it is.